This is the best of a conversation with the reluctant therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Happy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this week we have a guest in studio to talk about family communications. Communications, it is at the heart of everything in our lives, how we access love, how we maintain love, how we move through difficult situations, how we create our own realities, how we bring together our friend groups, how we initiate opportunities. All of it comes down to communications. And interestingly, it's one of the few things that isn't taught in elementary school, in high school, and in most colleges, unless, of course, you search out some sort of communication class. We encourage people to take speech and debate, which is a great form of communication when it comes to persuading people, learning to share your story. But those fundamental basic communication skills, how do I express love? How do I express disappointment? How do I self-disclose in such a way that creates intimacy in my most important relationships? Those foundational skills really are not innate. They're not something that we're born with. We're born with the ability to speak, but just because words fall out of our mouth doesn't mean that we're actually communicating in a way that's effective or even helpful. And so that's an ongoing challenge to family relationships and interpersonal relationships, is how do we take so many diverse ways of approaching communication and create relationships? Because we learn our communication skills from our family of origin, first and foremost. If your family was very outgoing and very assertive and everyone was encouraged to speak their mind and share their thoughts, and then you choose a partner who grew up in a family where there was very little open communication, were mostly repressive, mostly taught to kind of keep your thoughts to yourself. If you come with these two completely different family of origin communication styles, then how do you take those two different styles and create one cohesive communication experience in your relationship? So it's not surprising that when it comes to couples counseling, one of the primary challenges is how does the couple communicate their needs and desires and wants and frustrations effectively together? And so interesting about therapy is that really good therapy should be communication skill teaching. It should be about teaching communication skills. Because if we're able to express ourselves and feel heard and feel witnessed, a lot of those things that are challenging in relationships would really go away. If we were able to, in our families, talk about the things that matter to us in a way that feels safe, families would feel more connected. And then the other key is how do we take responsibility, personal responsibility, for the things that come out of our mouth? Because one of the challenges today in modern communication is social media, where there's this opportunity to respond to things in such a way that you don't have to take personal responsibility for what is being said, because it's anonymous or it's not in person, that you have this distance between a text message or something that's on a social media app, and you can respond in the moment with just a gut instinct or emotional response. And then you don't really have to be held responsible for how the person receives what it is you're sharing or what it is you're trying to say. And so we've lost a bit of that emotional and personal responsibility that goes into, hey, if I'm going to say something, I need to think about how other people are going to receive it or feel when they hear what I have to say. And then to take another breath and decide, should I be sharing what it is I think I need to say? Because how is this going to impact the relationship that I'm engaged in? So today, my guest, Dr. Dawn O'Braithwaite, is going to come in and talk about her experience teaching communication studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and also writing Communication Matters, her blog for Psychology Today, around what it is to have close relationships and the communication challenges within family relationships, and how we can all maybe learn a few tips on how to best create long-lasting and healthy relationships. So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation by sending me an email after the show to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, and you can podcast our show to listen at your convenience wherever it is you get your podcast. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and we'll be there. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back and start our conversation with Dr. Dawn O'Braithwaite right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Waiting on the day when my thoughts are my own, when this house is my home and plans are made, when you'll be there for me, baby.
You're listening to the best of A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. We can't take your phone calls today, but please enjoy this program.
When you take my side in every little firefight, when you hang your things and stay, I'm waiting.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm happy today to introduce my guest, Dr. Dawn O'Braithwaite, a Willa Cather Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Dr. Braithwaite studies how people in close and family relationships communicate during times of family and relationship stress and transition. Dr. Braithwaite is a specialist in interpersonal and family communication and a distinguished scholar and past president of the National Communication Association. Dr. Braithwaite has published 6 books and has won multiple awards for her work and service in the field of communication. You can also find Dr. Braithwaite's work in her blog, Communication Matters, which is part of Psychology Today. Dr. Braithwaite, thank you so much for joining me today. So Dr. Braithwaite, I'm really curious about what drew you to study communication specifically around family, found family and relationships. What was the initial interest in that for you?
You know, I was always sort of interested in communication my whole life. And when I was in junior high, there was the late 60s, there was a sign on the wall in my classroom that said, communication is the beginning of understanding. I think it was actually an ad for the Bell Telephone Company. And I just couldn't stop staring at it, because I was even aware at that time we studied math, we studied science, we studied English, but we really never studied communication. And in a way, the field in the interpersonal and family part, that's partly because it really wasn't going yet. We're more of a discipline of rhetoric, you know, going all the way back to Greece and before. And so that just always got to me. And then when I started college, there was a little bit about that in high school, but when I started college, there was all of a sudden courses in interpersonal communication. And I fought to get in that first semester. I heard it was a class everybody wanted. And I just went and sat in there and was a general pest till the guy let me in. And that was that. I did all of my degrees in communication. For me, studying in relationships and family, my family, I was an adopted kid. My mom died when I was 12, and we immediately became a step family 3 months later. And I just had a lot of family issues that to this day are kind of tough. You know, they don't really go away, and there's good things about them and bad things about them. But I was really aware of the importance. And so I think my whole life I've been interested in, and I've studied step families. I study chosen kin, those voluntary kin, those people you feel like are family. In some ways, all of this, I study family rituals. All these things are kind of related as families communicate to become families. Hmm. And that's the key for me. It's how we become families. It's how we have relationships. They're built in communication.
That's beautiful. And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I grew up in Chicago, and then my stepmother, we moved out here, and I finished high school here. And I'm here. Well, you don't know where I am. I'm in California, Southern California. And then I went to Golden West College in Huntington Beach, a community college, Cal State Fullerton, Cal State Long Beach, and then went back to the Midwest for my PhD at the University of Minnesota, or Minnesota, as we called it at the time.
And so how it's interesting because I was a communication studies major at UC
Oh,
Santa Barbara. So
so
as
was
soon
my
as I,
husband.
oh, we may have
Yeah.
been in school together. But so I was so drawn to your work because I went into communication studies with the intention of being a sportscaster. And so our department was very much about broadcasting and communication, through the medias. But then the classes that I kept signing up for were interpersonal communication, parent-child communication. I kept taking those classes, not really sure why, but obviously because, like many people, it was so confusing. Communication was so confusing to me because I always felt like I was very straightforward and honest and thought I was expressing myself well. And then people would respond as if I had spoken a different language or that, would dismiss it. And so I think my draw, maybe somewhat like yours, was this sense of feeling like an odd person out in my communication style and wondering why I always felt like I was the one calling out the emperor for having no clothes on and then being told that was, don't bring that up or don't say that or you're, And so communication felt like a way to explain or maybe find some comfort in that. And like you said, I don't know if we ever completely master it because we can't control the people that we are communicating with. So no matter how effective our communication skills are, there's always that piece. And I guess I'd like to ask you about that because that's always been the grand mystery. It's like how in families do, and maybe this is too big of a question to start out with, but I'm going to ask it. How in families, if you have different communication styles or different lenses of reality of the situation, even find common ground? And I'll start
Yeah, I mean
with that.
that's it's a real million-dollar question. I think in my own family, I was always sort of the odd guy out, you know. I just had different thoughts about things, different political views in my own mind. Early on, I didn't know that's what they were. And so yeah, I think in families, and you know, one of the things we haven't talked about much yet, but I mean, is power. You know, parents have power. And back when I was raised, dads especially had power, you know, and so my dad, we would talk about things till my dad got uncomfortable, which was pretty quick. And then he would say the phrase, "Nuff said," NUFF. Or if we had a conflict and we were trying to figure things out, and he would cut off discussion, and that was it. Dad's word went. And I think it one of the things in family that's difficult is you're dealing with everything from culture, you're dealing with gender, you're dealing with power, you're dealing with age. You know, you're dealing with all of those differences when you think, well, a family should be rather similar, but often we're not. And then as you know, as we change through time, as things happen in the family, a death in the family, or different people, you know, marry or partner into the family, more children. I mean, so many things happen that what's really difficult and challenging about family communication is families, it's reality is always changing. Families and people are always changing. And that's true in all relationships. And I always told my students, once you figure it out, you feel like, oh, I'm dating somebody, I kind of figured him out. And then, you know, something changes. We become closer, we become more serious. So that's one of the things that's challenging. And then the times change. You know, and so what we might have been raised to believe, we find that we don't believe that in the same way. And then the family's upset. We're right now, I've got a former student now who has been studying for years. What happens when a member of the family starts practicing wants to practice different religious beliefs? And that's really difficult for some families, you know, and certainly for parents who feel like their child now might be going to hell or, you know, I mean, it really is can tear families apart.
It's interesting because I do a communications section in my family psychology class, because I believe that it is fundamental for the success of all aspects of our life. And the question that comes every quarter for my students is, Professor Barrett, on one hand, you're teaching us these assertive communication skills and how to be open and vulnerable and use I statements. And yet you're saying, but you might not be safe enough to use these skills within your own family system. And that's another conversation. How do, let's start with that, because there is a different communication expectation within the family because, as you mentioned, power. And it might not be safe to speak your mind or say your truth. And so is the goal of family communication compromise and repression of thought for the peace of the family?
Well, I mean, sometimes I suppose, but I think the goal is, again, we try to look at communicative competence. And one of the main parts of the aspects of communication, communicative competence is flexibility. You know, there's not one way to communicate. And now, when I grew up, again, men and my, dads in the family were kind of powerful. They really didn't have to change. How they needed no, my dad needed no flexibility. I remember one time he took me to the office for the day, and I realized he, I kind of figured out at about 10, he talked to me just like he talked to his secretaries. Neither of them were particularly awful, but he never had to change. But today, even being a parent, his style would not be as effective. His style in the workplace would not be effective. And so I think with families, we've come to realize that you need that communicative competence. You need flexibility so that you communicate with different, you might communicate differently with a grandparent, everything from raising your volume to you may not use swear words, or you might not tell them certain things. Don't tell grandma that this person is gay, for example. Families come up with these rules about what you should and should not say. So I think it's not that you just have to swallow and repress everything, but I think you have to think wisely about what your goals are and what's the best way to get to your goals. And so, I confronted my dad a couple of times during my life, but I really thought about what, as one of my good friends says, is this a hill I want to die on? You know, what is really worth it, and what are my goals in any situation? So, yeah, I think it's more complicated than just saying, and I know you know that, and then just swallowing what you want, and you never get what you want. But there are times when I've told people, I think you communicate in the most effective way you can, and then if nothing else, you tried. You know, and I felt that way many times with family and others. It's like, all right, I'm going to give it my best shot. It's not that I'm going to be perfect. Or if it didn't, if it didn't work out, well, what can I learn from that? And what can we go back and try another time? Because you can't, as you said before, you cannot control how other people perceive things. You cannot even control how sometimes how you perceive things. So you've got to really roll with the punches.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm speaking with my guest today, Dr. Dawn O'Braithwaite, Willow Cather Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. So it's interesting because you said that the times change, and they absolutely do, because I think with my students and the generation I'm working with today, they feel very empowered to speak their mind all the time. And so there's that piece as well. That when you offer, I'll say, compromise and, emotional maturity and sometimes holding back is the better choice, they find that really difficult, that they are much more apt to go after anyone that disagrees with them, their parents, both, mother and father, because as you said, the dynamics have changed. A lot of parents don't even hold that authority in their own home. And I wonder how that impacts communication. Are parents just trying to keep their children happy, whereas two
I don't
generations
know.
ago it
I'm
didn't
not,
matter.
my expertise, I don't have a real expertise in parent-child communication. I mean, I just observing things, I think, yeah, for as a college professor, I think you're right. Kids are, they're more open. They're even more likely to tell you things like, I just started my paper yesterday and that, I'm thinking to myself, don't tell me that, you know. I don't really want to know that. I can't un communication in one of the, I'm sure you learned in your basic course, communication's irreversible and unrepeatable. You can't take things back. And so knowing what to say and that what not, one of the theories I work with is called communication privacy management. And it that goes to, you've got to figure out what's the most appropriate thing to say and not say? And when is it the wisest thing not to say something? And I think students are always surprised when they hear that coming from a communication professor. My husband and I had, we've had very few conflicts with people over the years, but we ended up in for a long story, which I wouldn't tell you anyway, we ended up in a conflict with some dear, dear friends, and we didn't see each other for quite a while. And finally, my husband came, or I came to my husband, they were moving to a new house, and I said, "Hey, I wonder if we should offer to bring them dinner." And he said, "Yeah, that's great." And I offered and they took it, and we went over and had dinner, and we worked our way back together. We never talked, and these are people that were involved in my discipline. We never talked about it, and I think that was the wise thing to do, because I don't think we were going to win by talking about it. I don't think there was anything we could do, and I think we all decided in our own ways, I suspect, not to try to fix the past and go forward, and we were changed. We were different. But the difference not bad either. So that's some of my thoughts about that. But with families, it's so complicated because, unless you're going to be estranged, which is another topic that's really big today. You have to figure out how to be with people.
Well, and I do think that that's such an important line of thought because, as you said, people assume that communication experts are going to always encourage talk it through, make sure you come to resolution, make sure everyone gets heard. And my experience, and I'm hearing from you as well, which actually makes me feel affirmed, is that sometimes silence is the better move, and that we can't always have full honesty. And I also remember the books. Okay, remember the books about Naked Truth, I can't remember what it was called, but
Oh, yeah.
Radical Honesty
Yeah.
was the book. And I remember being so taken back by that, because sometimes, as you said, once you've said things, you can't pull it back into the bottle, and you've done irreparable damage. And sometimes you might get into something that you can never solve, and it is better to just move away as if it never happened. And that seems so untenable. Again, I think for modern communication styles, people can't accept that in a civil society, not talking can be the thing that keeps families together. And can you expand on that, what that looks like? Because
I
people, I
just
think,
think,
fear that they wouldn't be as close, right? Well, how can I be close to someone if I haven't told them every thought I've ever had?
yeah, and that's probably one of the mistakes, right? To think that revelation equals closeness. And again, as a kid raised in the 60s, and as I took my first interpersonal communication classes in the early 70s, we were taught to let it all hang out. And we played a game in my class, and I do this in my class. I don't intend to play it, but I would say the professor put a chair in the middle of a circle. We were all sat in a circle, and what did we call it? I can't remember what it was called, but basically, you sat in the hot seat for like 10 minutes or something, and everybody could ask you questions, and you didn't have to answer them. But it's that old thing of, well, when's the last time you beat your wife? You can't win. You can't say, well, I don't want to answer that, because some people think, well, now I'm sure you did that. And so that's one of the really tough ones. And so I kind of, I put the chair in the middle, and I'd say to my students today, do you want to play this? And I have to admit, when we played it in the early 70s, it was rather pleasant. And people asked some pretty personal questions, because that's what this class taught us to do. And I say, and a lot of us students, oh, yeah, I want to play. And I was like, well, why? Well, I want to learn stuff about people. And it's like, well, start thinking about this. What are and by the time I'm finished with them, nobody wants to play. And I think we are also in more dangerous times. I think we're in different times than the 60s and the early 70s, where everybody could be really open. But now, especially with social media and so much in people, you can write something on social media and people may be fishing around to find out about you, And so I think that's one of the things, even with fan now, that's a little different than families, but I think it's relevant. It's this idea that saying everything is how you get close, and that sometimes, especially if you have no revelation, if you never tell somebody what you think, I think it would be hard to be close. But I think there's also different kinds of closeness, and so it's figuring out where's that person right now, and what's the best way that I can, be supportive of their relationship, be protective of them and me. And even kids, I think, could be trained to think about that a little bit. What would be, just had a really difficult situation come up in my life with a friend who's, and somebody else sort of a, I have a friend who's transgender, and somebody objected to me putting this person on a contact list. It's a long, long story. And I called my friend and said, I need to tell you what's going on. And her response was, what would be the kindest thing to do? And boy, I really respected that because I think she was also saying, I think she was truly saying kindest. But I think it wrapped up in that was, what's the most appropriate? What's going to make this situation the best it could be? She completely understands that not everybody's going to accept her. And that really struck me in a very special way. I thought, wow, this is a special. She's not angry. She's not screaming. She's just saying, you know, what's the best thing to do?
And I
So
think
I guess
that's a
with families,
level.
that's a question to ask.
Yeah, and that feels like that requires a level of emotional maturity on the part of the individual to be able to put the collective above the self. And I think that's another shift that's happened socially is that we're so focused on the individual, we don't value the collective. And a family is a collective of people that exist for the betterment of the whole. And so that requires then for the whole to survive that everyone puts their own individual needs almost second. And again, that feels so counter to the social narrative. And maybe that's why families are struggling right now, because the reality of what makes a family successful and how we as society think we should be are at odds.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say to go back to one of the things we write about in some of our family books is, you know, not all families are good, not all families are healthy. So families, I don't think are inherently, I mean, generally to culture, I think that families that come in all different forms, by the way, are important. But you know, I think you have to, you know, decide is this. Do I want to have a relationship with these folks? Is it healthy for me? And there's times when people step out of that for a while or even permanently, and say, you know, I just think the best thing, you know, the best thing for me right now, and maybe the best thing for everybody, is for me to have my needs met somewhere else. And so people do that, and they put together sometimes alternate families, chosen families, and sometimes they have both a biological or a legal family and a chosen family too, and. That there are different people in their lives that where they feel comfortable or can meet different needs. So sometimes maybe we put so much stress and pressure on the family to be all to us. And if they can't be or they're not, then we have, I can think of a person in my life that doesn't really believe in chosen family. And that's okay. I mean, not everybody has to have that in their lives. I certainly did and certainly still do. But if you do that, boy, in some ways your eggs are all in that one family basket. And if lots of people pass away and you have no, you know, too many people, family members left, or you just can't get along or anything, you've got nothing to fall back on. So I think it also putting too much pressure on what it means to be a family and what we need to get from them and give, be just as bad as, you know, not seeking it at all, I guess.
You know, well, Murray Bowen, one of the, founders of the family systems theory, talked about the intensity of psychic energy and that when we put too much pressure on the nuclear family itself, just the immediate family, that it's too much, that it needs to be spread amongst the community and others. So I think that's a really valid point. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Donna Braithwaite, and we're talking about communication within families and the challenges sometimes that go along with communication. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
As I was saying, just before you left the room, before I assumed that you might not come around. As I was saying, just after I took my foot from my mouth and put it back on the ground.
This is the best of A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
You, and I don't want to disappear from here. Or now, or you, is worth saving, 'cause the sum of us is more than us. If you add us up, then subtract.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Dr. Donna Braithwaite, a Willa Cather Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Dr. Braithwaite studies how people in close and family relationships communicate during times of family and relationship transition and stress, especially post-breakup, step-family, and chosen family relationships. Dr. Braithwaite is a specialist in interpersonal and family communication and is a distinguished scholar and past president of the National Communication Association. Dr. Braithwaite has published six books and won multiple awards and is very active with her blog, Communication Matters, which is found through Psychology Today. So, Dr. Braithwaite, one of the terms that you used in your work is called the role of the family kinkeepers. I've never heard that term before, and I'm curious to know what that looks like and what that is.
Yeah, the kinkeepers are people that do communication. It's sort of, can think about it as people that do communication work in families. They keep people together. They may be the person that writes a newsletter, plans a reunion, tells the family if somebody's having surgery. They may have a blog these days. You know, they do all sorts of things to keep families going, and they're mostly positive roles. We found over the years that they're mostly women, but not always. And we've been studying in more recent years the role of social media in all of this. Mm-hmm. When we first started studying, there was email, but there wasn't social media to where people could keep together electronically and even by FaceTime and all the ways that we keep together today. So it's a really interesting and sort of complicated role in families as well. But I think it could be, and I don't know that every family has one, but I suspect that lots of them do.
Is it a designated role in families, or is it a by circumstance? Like, how does that?
It's a good question. I think that most of the time it's somebody who steps forward and does it. And I think in families, if the family's had a kinkeeper, another person may step in as that person ages. So as women age, you know, a younger woman or just another younger person may step in and take that role. There could be more than one. I think a family could possibly designate the role. I haven't heard of too many families that did. It seems to be much more of an informal role, which is part of what makes it tricky, right? Mm-hmm. Because you could act sometimes, and there are also friend keepers, people that do this for groups of friends. And they're just tricky roles because you could easily get stuck in the middle and get yourself in trouble. You know, you're sort of you can be a powerful person because you're a gatekeeper. You get to decide what people know and don't know and how. But I think, you know, I think it is a more informal, generally, I suspect it's a more informal role from what we know.
And how does that do with the navigating of family rituals, you know, and traditions and get-togethers? Yes. Are those two things aligned?
They can be. I mean, and family kinkeepers are often people who, you know, plan dinners, plan reunions, plan events, birthday parties, keep people, you know, posted about those things. Even when somebody passes, one of my friends just passed away. He's sort of my chosen dad and passed away at 98. And it was interesting to see who in the family stepped, their bio-legal family. I could have guessed. And it was the people I thought that was sort of just generally always step forward and, you know, take on different roles. And it's interesting with families to watch that happen. So that's what, you know, what in the best of circumstances, what kinkeepers do. And they, again, it can be, because families generally don't live next door to each other. Sometimes they're not even geographically close at all. And so sometimes kinkeeping is even more important to keep families, you know, going and informed.
I know, and it seems like one of those parts of family life that with the increased busyness and stress and strain on families with multiple, you know, jobs that are needed to keep the families afloat, that my concern would be that role of family kinkeeper would be lost and would be one of the reasons that families are struggling to stay close and connected.
Yeah, it's harder to do it, when for a person who might be a kin keeper who's trying to raise kids, maybe caring for elderly parents, trying to do the kin keeper thing, that's challenging. And so again, if a family loses a kin keeper, somebody passes away or gets sick, they may not know how to, and I'm always really concerned because I tend to be this person who keeps a lot of these lists to make sure I'm not the only person that has it, for example. So if I go down, that other people, could, you're hoping that other people could step in. So yeah, I think that's one of the challenges. In a very busy world, it's important, but in a very busy world, it's maybe more challenging.
So, when it comes to the communication stresses during times of, transition, what are some things that you see? I'm not even sure how what I'm asking, but how does communication change or need to change that you've noticed when there's a transition or trauma or a loss within a family system?
There's a scholar named Patrice Busnell who talks about the communicative resilience. And lots of people today are, it's kind of a hot topic out there, right? In psychology and in sociology and everywhere else. From a communication perspective, we see this, when you need to develop or increase or deal with family resilience, you do that through communication. And Busnell talks about, how does a family find its new normal? And so, sometimes it's we have to make some mistakes and talk it through and correct the course, and figure out, well, again, maybe we're not going to have the I think we might worry about these things today. We may not have the socioeconomic means we thought we were going to have. I've got friends here in California who lost their homes last month, they burned down during the fires in LA. When you're in those situations, I mean, those are really difficult situations, but where everything is sort of upside down, and the family has to figure out how to sort of right the ship. And so, who's going to step forward and help with that? And what are different people going to do? I think a kin keeper might be helpful at that time if the family has a person they trust who's a good coordinator and can, again, sort of. It has the technological skills to figure out how to find everybody and keep everybody, posted and figure out just physically right now where everybody is at any given time. So resilience is part of this too. And again, we see this discovering this new normal. It's not that it's always it's perfect. It's not that nobody makes mistakes while trying to do this. And so I think that's, how do you sort of develop that new normal? How do you interact in ways? And again, what do you say? And we were talking earlier about not say, it's not just blurting everything out at all times, but figuring out, well, what would be the kindest thing to do right now? What would be the most effective things I could do for myself and the members of my family? And if everybody can think that way in the best way they can while they're hurting, they're going to make mistakes. And I'll say one other quick thing is that's the other thing is I think that just sometimes we don't appreciate, we're always looking for what we have in common, but we're not appreciating differences. Not everybody grieves the same way. My graduate student did a study years ago of parents who'd lost a child, and that's terrible. I don't know how anybody survives it. And one of the things that's challenging is what happens when that couple, they grieve differently. And she did a study of grieving together and grieving apart that we published, because sometimes they just can't grieve together. And they have to accept, as much as I might want to talk it through, my spouse may want to back up or my children. So that's what makes communication so complicated and kind of challenging and intriguing at the same time.
I find one of the most challenging parts of communication is when you're generally aligned with someone and have an easy rapport, and feel very close, but then you hit an impasse of something, like for whatever reason, you're not connecting, and how much anxiety that creates because you're trying to make yourself understood, but your partner or whoever the partner is in that communication, you're not getting each other. And that's really frightening. And so what are the steps? Do you remove yourself? Do you try to keep talking it through? What is the dance for that kind of impasse?
I think if nothing else, and you remember that proviso I mentioned earlier, that communication is irreversible and unrepeatable. You know, sometimes you have, I could think in my life, with family or maybe even friends are just having a real special day, a really great time talking. And then you realizing you can't recreate that, you know. Maybe you never have a wonder that kind of talk or that kind of day with that person ever again. And even if it's the person that's close to you, you can't repeat it. And I think this that's the unrepeatable part. But the irreversible part is the big one to me. You can't say, we say it all the time, pretend I never said anything. Well, you can ask somebody to do that, but you better darn well know they can't. You can't forget what somebody said or did. Doesn't mean you can't forgive. And that's why forgiveness is another topic that, and we've studied that in step families and other places. I've got colleagues who are national experts in forgiveness. Not so much me, but I'm interested in it. And so I'll give an example with my own step family. When I was in my mid-20s, I one day woke up and said, man, or maybe it was about 26 or 7, and I said, I have to forgive my dad and my stepmom. And because it was tough, and of course it was tough for them too. And if I was going to sit around and harbor resentments, I was not going to have be able to have a good relationship with them. And I never told them. They didn't really need, and we don't always with forgiveness tell the person that we're forgiving them. Sometimes we talk it through, but it was just that was one of the best things I ever did. Because it gave me the freedom to move forward. So sometimes we don't talk about it and we just say, you know, I just lifted my hand up, like, you know. And then other times, you know, I think it's just thinking strategically about what and when. Maybe this isn't the time. You know, maybe I need to let them know how I'm feeling over a series of conversations rather than just going and blowing it all out. So it there hardly is ever, I think the frustrating part is there's hardly ever an easy answer. But I think people just get all wound up and emotional, you know, full of emotion and blurt stuff out without saying, well, let me take it back. I think we do need to talk about that, or I need for us to talk this through, or we need to come to a new understanding about X, what we're going to talk about or not. But that it may not, you know, go the way I want it to, you know. So, and I think that's the last thing I'll say about, but or just before you want to ask another question, you got to know what you want. Sometimes I really don't know what I want. You know, it's like this stinks. I don't like it. But then I have to ask myself, what do I want? Knowing that person, knowing the situation we're in, you know, knowing X, Y, and Z, what would be the best outcome for today? Knowing that that could change too.
Which is such a powerful part of conflict resolution, is to go into the conflict knowing what would need to change for you to feel okay and not going into it just being angry at the other person. Because without a goal, then you just can get caught in the mire of feelings and there's no resolution.
And I
If you're
actually like even the term conflict management, even a for me, a little better, just because I think we hardly ever resolve conflicts.
agreed.
You know, you could get a person to, I mean, this is so stereotypical. You know, I could get my husband to maybe not leave his flip-flops right by the door, but then next time it's his baseball hat or so. You know, I mean, it's stuff like that that conflicts are hardly ever resolved, but it's more that we manage them to the best of our ability in a way that creates the best win. You know, if we love people, we'd want the best win we can for ourselves, but also for the other person and the family. So how do we respect differences, I think, is way more important than similarities. And differences are powerful. You know, they move us places. That's why we're often attracted to people who are different than we are.
Yes, I love the there's a great piece that talks about all the reasons we're attracted to our partner, and then all the reasons we have conflict, and they're the exact same thing. You know, I love how spontaneous my partner is, and I hate that things are always spontaneous. So there's the things that we love. So yes, having that forgiveness and that grace, and also understanding that at the end of the day, it's the love that's important, and not really the being right in the moment. And if you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest is Dr. Donna Braithwaite, a communication studies expert. And there are two things that I don't want to forget to that we get to. But I want to sidetrack because you talk about, the strategic part of communication. I always go back to Jay Haley and strategic communication systems and his idea that all communication is strategic and in some ways manipulative, that we're always using communication to advance an agenda. How do we then have any pureness of communication if that is true?
I don't
Or
even know
do
why,
you believe
in a way,
that?
well, I don't know that I believe in pureness of communication. I would say that all communication, and I've taught this for years, all communication is persuasive. And
Okay.
it's different, and you're, and sometimes there is manipulation. You know, we can manipulate somebody into doing what we want. We can coerce them, we can force them, hold a gun to their head, or you know, we're going to punish them or not talk to them. But you know, we're always trying to persuade people about something. So today, I'm trying to, in a way, I'm not, you know, I'm communicating in such a way that you and hopefully your listeners will see me as credible. And that I know my stuff, right? Everything we do. So the fact that I showed up on time, the fact that I prepared, the fact that, you know what I mean? It's everything we do has a suasory or persuasive aspect to it. And I think that's important because, again, it goes back to goals. What am I trying to accomplish here? And I don't mean that, well, sometimes we do manipulate people. So you can think, well, gosh, I'll hide the truth and then they won't know. That's manipulation. And again, or I'll force them. I'll call their bluff, and I'll, like a kid, I'll take away their allowance. That's coercion, and sometimes that's a good thing to do as a parent. I mean, you have to figure out what your goal is and how to best get there. But in close relationships, I think it's understanding what, how do you know? There's a theory called, it's old, Irving Goffman, you know, face work, you know, and that's really how do I want other people to see me, and that we are in some ways. We're always on stage, even with the people that are closest to us, you know, and that's sometimes that's helpful. You know, I'm feeling really crabby today, but if nothing else, I don't want my husband to think I'm a real jerk. You know, now we're retired, we're at the house together all the time, you know, and so sometimes remembering, well, how do I want to be seen? Even if I don't feel that way today, kind of puts me on report to say, okay, well, then I better, you know, not say this, or I better not do that. So all of these different communication theories really do. I don't say that I always use them, but I sometimes ignore them to my peril. I'm married to a communication expert, so you'd think we'd know better. But sometimes we do it. Sometimes we know better, but we do it anyway, right? So.
Which is what I love to say to my students as well, you know, that I've been with my husband for almost 45 years, and I still fall prey to the things I did when we were 19 and first met, because that love and passion piece outweighs sometimes my intellect. Because we're emotionally vested in each other, and so you're responding from emotion and not just you're no better. I'm curious about your blog that you write for Psychology Today, Communication Matters, and that's accessible to anyone who wants to read it. What are some of the hot topics that you're following and have been for the last year or so?
You know, it's really interesting. Out of all, I've been writing these for 3 years. Sometimes I write them with a co-author too. The one that's gotten the most readers, the last I looked, it was about 170,000 readers, was on family estrangement, by far more than other things that we've published. So that is something that people are really thinking about. And it's the only blog I've written where people also wrote me at the university kind of upset about this, that because we sort of said sometimes estrangement's healthy, you know. And we're not, and people, how can you tell people that? I'm not telling people they should be estranged. I'm just telling you that for some people, you know, getting away, maybe taking a break or just getting away, you know, that's going to be the healthiest thing I mean, we've interviewed people that have said that, and that's, you know, so that's probably one of the most, I've written about family kinkeepers. I've written about chosen families, written about how people share affection. And don't. And so we've written just about kind of any interpersonal and family topic I can think of. And every month I'm trying to come up with something.
Something
We've written
fresh.
around the elections, just, you know, how to communicate when there's differences with neighbors or with family and friends. And so it's these, but if you've never looked at the family blogs for your listeners, or just the Psych Today blogs, there's hundreds of them, and they come out every day. I think they have 1 million readers a day. They're free, and they're about 1,500 words, so they're really quick to read. And I enjoy just kind of I just get stuck, and I can find an hour went by, and I'm just following. You know, each one suggests another one, and most of the people that write them, we're writing them for free. It's just something that people, a lot of academics and therapists and other professionals. So it's, I like the blogs a lot. And mine are all around this idea that communication is how we create and maintain and change and relationships.
So let's end on the topic of politics and how that's changed family dynamics, not just with this election, but over the last 10 years, it feels like it's been disarray. What are some things that you might be able to share with my listeners that they could incorporate or give them hope or?
This is a
I
really tough time.
know.
Social media, people are blaming social media. I don't want to give up on social media because it's, I do enjoy, I'm a little older, so I'm much more of a Facebook. I do use Instagram. Just being able to, I'd love to see people's pictures of the kids of the first day of school. And so I have decided to try to look and not give up on my friends and family and just be able to see their lives and know what's going on without getting involved. So on my page, I don't let, I had a friend that was getting on there and fighting with all of my friends. And I probably one of the only people I've unfriended on Facebook because it's like, no, you want to come fight with me, call me up, but you don't get to fight with my friends. But I think people have to be careful. Again, communication's irreversible. What you say to your family. And so, we are just so divided. I don't know. I don't have a lot of easy answers. I think in some families right now, if, for example, holidays are really painful, Thanksgiving was awful, you might come and you, as a family, might, and sometimes kinkeepers or, yeah, kinkeepers can be helpful with this, is to make a rule. Look, we're just going to sort of say no politics at the table and see if we can do that. Or we may divide into a couple of groups for a while to have, maybe we're not so great at sitting at a table where everybody looks each other. But if we went to out to a park where the kids could run around and everybody could play some sports, or we could go in and watch football at home, just I think sitting there facing each other, I think that's where it just gets hard right now. So even your family rituals, this might be a time to change them a little bit and not just double down. We have to get together, be there. Well, maybe I don't have to be there. And you might find a way out. There just might be a way that you don't make it to Thanksgiving this year. And I mean, you again, there it's hard because every family's different and what the fix is. But I think it's important to realize these are your real life relationships, and they're not going to stay close or together if you don't put some effort toward it. So, just trying to think again a little bit strategically about what would make a difference this year. What would be a good thing for us to do? Might be, and maybe talk about that with a subset of people and make some agreements about it. I mean, I think it's worth trying because right now families are so fractured. It's, oh gosh, it's just, I just hate to see it. Even on just on social media, how people talk to each other. Somebody raises a question, and the ugliness of the responses. And I think that's because you don't have to face somebody, and people will just say anything and blast off. And boy, it's not pretty out there at all.
No, and I think that part of the challenge, and you've and mentioned it earlier, is that we don't truly understand what the goal and purpose of our family is, that we've made families fairly throw away. And that's a change since the 1970s that we've seen families as replaceable or as, not as important. And so people are very quick to just cast off their family or cast off relationships. And maybe part of the key is that there needs to be some sort of understanding of what the purpose of the family unit is and why it's important and what the goals are, so that then we know how to behave to support that. It's like a business's mission statement. If you sign on to be a part of this business, you're going to follow what the mission statement is of that. So maybe families need to work on creating a mission statement that supersedes our own individual thoughts and needs and desires.
Yeah, but that, I mean, again, that might be something that a family, gives a try to. And I think for me, it's not so much that, well, I think families can be throwaway, but I think that, maybe it's okay not to have all of your needs met by your
Agreed.
biological family. That there may be times, and that's, I think that's happened to me a little more naturally because I never lived around my family, my biolegal family, since I was in my 20s somewhere. And so it was just this idea that, we formed, we did our holidays with certain people, and and it was a lot more pleasant, and and so that we could get together with our family. With when we do get together, there's a little bit less pressure on,
Have it be perfect.
And so I think it's oh, it, I think for me it's okay, and sometimes it's even what's the word? It's even better to find people. I'll give you a quick example. I'm probably not being very cogent. One of my students is doing her dissertation on voluntary families, chosen families for people who've been in the military, military veterans. And this idea that when you've been in the military, you might not be allowed to talk about certain things you're doing or you did, or you just nobody don't think anybody could understand. So, you may need to have those needs met by other people in your life. And I think that can bring a lot of strengths and take some pressure off families too.
Agreed. Agreed. Dr. Braithwaite, thank you so much for spending this hour with me. It always goes too fast, but I appreciate your time. If people want to hear more of your thoughts, they can find you on Psychology Today. I'm assuming it's psychologytoday.com.
I don't know. I think so. I think if you type in Psychology Today blogs
Yes,
and
it pops
type in
up pretty
my
quickly.
name or Communication Matters,
There you go.
it should come up.
So you find out more about different strategies for working with families in different challenging situations. As always, I thank you for your time. I thank you for tuning in. If you'd like more information, you can also send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, podcast our show. Anywhere that is that you get your podcast, just put in a conversation with a reluctant therapist and hit search and hit subscribe, and you'll be able to listen at your convenience. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. But as always, I appreciate you taking the time to tune in and support Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
spoke too soon. Then someone asked me what I need. I had a new pen, I just couldn't make it bleed. I had a new pen, I just couldn't make it bleed. So much to lose. How can I say?